All right, thank you very much for the invitation to speak, and thank you to all the organizers. I'm really grateful to be able to attend such a wonderful conference. So today my goal is to convince you that the explanation is not so fake, even though it involves some exotic ingredients. Okay, so according to Einstein gravity, black holes are maximally chaotic systems. So they have a chaos exponent that saturates the chaos bound. And one point of view on this equation is that this equation is a consequence of the near horizon symmetries of black holes. Okay, so for near extremal black holes that are very low temperature, they have a long ADS2 throat, and the near horizon symmetries are the SL2 symmetries of nearly ADS2. Okay, and in previous work, we discussed generators that move the matter with respect to the Schwarzschild boundary in this limit. Okay, and these generators preserve the length of the wormhole. Now, in Euclidean signature, I've also depicted the three generators here, and the important point is that there are some P plus and P minus, which are null generators of translation, and using the definition of the boost, we can see that the SL2 algebra immediately implies that there's a maximal chaos exponent with 2 pi over beta, like you saw in the previous slide. So in this sense, the symmetries dictate the chaos exponent. Okay, now to understand why P plus and P minus are relevant, you just need to consider the effects of gravitational scattering. So in particular, for 2-to-2 gravitational scattering near the black hole horizon, we can imagine that W is a shockwave, and V is a matter particle, and it crosses the shockwave. When it does so, it experiences a Shapiro time delay. So that's this little null shift. And near the horizon, that becomes P plus and P minus. Okay? So that's why that's the connection between scattering, SL2 symmetries, and chaos. Now, in string theory, or more generically in a quantum system, we don't expect a generic system to have maximal chaos. We expect it to be submaximal. And in a theory with a known string theory dual, it's expected that the effects that reduce the chaos exponent are alpha prime effects. And essentially, this is because string theory collisions are not point-like collisions. They're somehow more messy, and the inelastic effects reduce the chaos exponent. So a wish list would be to compute the actual chaos exponent in n equals 4 super Young mills at finite coupling and at finite temperature, let's say in the black hole phase. But of course, this is a very challenging goal, and even with the fancy techniques of integrability and so forth, it seems rather futuristic. Okay. However, there is a simpler model where the chaos exponent has already been computed, and it's been computed for a while. And that is the so-called large P SYK model. So that is a model where we have already a boundary computation of the chaos exponent, and it's given by this very simple formula. So V is close to 1 at very low temperatures or at strong coupling, and V can be, in general, 0.5 or 0.3 if you increase beta J. So if you go to higher temperatures, the chaos exponent can be less than 1. Okay, so this is a case where we have a formula, but we don't have a bulk explanation yet because we don't know what the bulk description of large PSYK is. And so the goal for today is to give an interpretation of why this chaos exponent is what it is. Okay, so the strategy will be to take a scenic detour. So the scenic detour is that first we will study a slightly more general theory called the double-scaled SYK, which we already encountered in the previous talk. And that seems like a harder problem because it's a more complicated theory. However, there's a special technique that can be applied in that context where we can actually construct some sort of bulk Hilbert space. And using this explicit bulk Hilbert space, we can find the action of the symmetries on this bulk Hilbert space. And then once we understand the symmetries in this more general context, we can go back to the large PSYK limit, and we will obtain some sort of explanation for the chaos exponent. So that's the strategy. And what we will find is something which we call fake geometry, which is some sort of subtlety with a continuum limit of going back to the large PSYK. Okay, so you've all seen the SYK Hamiltonian. Just to establish some notation, n is the number of Majorana fermions. P is the number, is the degree of the polynomial of the interaction. Okay, there are three dimensionless parameters in general for SYK, n, p, and beta j. And we are interested in the limit where n goes to infinity and p goes to infinity. So that leaves two dimensionless parameters, the ratio n over p squared and beta j. Okay, so I plotted these two dimensionless parameters here. The double-scaled SYK limit is completely general once you take the scalings that I've already mentioned. What we're interested in is large PSYK. This is the case where we want to explain the chaos exponent. what we already understand is the JT gravity limit, okay? So we would like to just go here, but instead what we're actually going to do is go down, study the double-scaled SYK theory, and then come back, okay? Now, it will prove useful to introduce this parameter lambda, which is 2p squared over n. And the idea is that lambda goes to zero corresponds to large p SYK, lambda is finite is the general theory. Okay, so as I've already said, there's a special technique called the chord diagram technique that applies in the double scaling limit. And this technique will be what we will use as a technical tool to analyze the symmetries of the theory. So the chord diagrammatic technique is extremely simple. And it was developed in a series of beautiful papers by Bricusse and collaborators. And the technique is as follows. Suppose you're interested in computing some simple correlation function. Let's say trace of the Hamiltonian to some power, and then perhaps some insertions of matter operators. Matter operators in this context are just products of fermions. And the length of the product of the fermion is p prime, which may be different than p. Okay, so if we're interested in computing something like this, the rule is we arrange on a circle the different operator insertions. Then we draw all possible Wick contractions, which are so-called chords between the different dots. And then intersections in this diagram get various penalty factors. So if two Hamiltonian chords cross these two black lines, they get a factor of e to the minus lambda, which is q. And if a matter chord, this green dot, crosses a black line, it gets a factor of r, which is q to the delta, basically. And the final step is we sum over all chord diagrams. So this technique was developed in previous work. In a paper last year, I explained how we can cut open the chord diagrams and define some sort of Hilbert space that, in an appropriate scaling limit, becomes the Hilbert space of JT gravity. So how that works is you simply take the chord diagram, you cut it open, and you assign a state, a ket vector, which labels what chords cross that line. So in this particular context, there's one black chord, one green chord, and one black chord. So we can call this state, if we like, 1, 1. So one means there's one black chord to the left of the green dot, and this one means that there's one chord to the right of the green dot, okay? So in general, it's a very concrete, finite, you know, very concrete, discrete Hilbert space. We can work out explicitly how operators act on this Hilbert space. And the simplest operator is, of course, the Hamiltonian. So let's consider the case where there's no matter particles. So then the Hamiltonian, for example, can do only one of two things. It can either create a new chord, which is this alpha dagger term, or it can annihilate a chord, which is this alpha term. When it annihilates the chord, it might intersect some number of chords. So we have to sum over the possible numbers of intersections, and that gives us some q-deformed integer that appears in the annihilation term. If we generalize now to the case with at least one matter particle, we see a very similar form for the Hamiltonian. So again, it can create one term, that's this diagram. It can annihilate a term. But there's two kinds of annihilations. It can either annihilate a right chord, like in this middle figure, or it can annihilate a left chord. And there's some appropriate weights given by these factors here. OK, and then there's also a left Hamiltonian. So the chord algebra, I can tell you exactly what it is now. It is simply the algebra generated by the left and right Hamiltonian and the chord number operator. OK, so the chord number operator counts the number of chords weighted by delta. And it is the discrete analog of the length of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So you should think of cutting this disk open and defining some sort of discrete version of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, and n bar is simply the length of the bridge. Okay? It has a microscopic interpretation too in terms of operator size, and it's also related to this Krylov complexity that was just discussed. Okay, the chord algebra then is a very simple algebra generated by the left and right Hamiltonians, and it's more convenient to write them in terms of these creation and annihilation operators. And you'll see that the creation and annihilation operators basically satisfy some sort of q-deformed version of the harmonic oscillator algebra, except importantly that they're coupled in some peculiar way. Okay, so these are some sort of coupled q-deformed harmonic oscillators, and the fact that they're q-deformed kind of makes sense from the fact that these q-deformed integers showed up in the previous slide. Now, this is just some algebra, so it's some nonlinear algebra, but it actually has more structure than that. So it's actually something known as a bialgebra. Okay, so that might sound scary, but it's actually not too bad. So an algebra is a vector space equipped with an associative product, okay? It's a rule for telling you how to multiply different elements in the algebra. A bialgebra is an algebra together with a new operation called the coproduct. And the coproduct tells you how to take one element of the algebra and produce two of them in the tensor product, okay? And the rules are that the coproduct has to be compatible with the multiplication operator in the defined by the algebra, okay? So it has to preserve the commutation relations that I defined in the previous slide. And there's some very concrete expressions for the co-product in this particular theory, and they have this form. Okay, but besides just telling you the expressions, there's actually a very simple physical interpretation, which is just that the co-product can be interpreted as the action of the regular algebra when we view the state in a very funny way. And the way that we view the state is we take some wormhole which potentially has, let's say, a blue matter particle in the middle, and we split it. So it means that we define a map from a single copy of the Hilbert space to two copies of the Hilbert space, where we now remove that blue particle, okay? And so this is the left part of the, what was the left part of the wormhole, and here's what's to the right of the wormhole. And similarly, delta joins two states into a bigger wormhole state. So this is, the co-product just acts naturally when we think of the wormhole in this particular way. And it's a very interesting, there's some interesting connection to the factorization problem, which you can ask me about later. So the main point of the co-product is it takes some representation which only involves a small number of matter particles and increases the number of matter particles. Every time you join the wormhole, you insert a potentially new matter particle. So by acting with the co-product, we can generate more complicated representations of the chord algebra. Okay, so we're going to use this now in 1 second. So the idea is we want to classify the representations of the chord algebra, and I'll just tell you the result. First of all, there's a short representation. So the short representation consists of the empty wormhole states. And other than that, there's also the one particle irreducible representations. And these are some sort of highest weight irreps, which are generated by starting with some primary state, satisfying this condition, and then acting with all the creation operators on that. And these are nothing but the two kinds of states that I discussed before, the empty wormhole states and the states with one matter particle. Okay? And the claim is that the chord Hilbert space actually decomposes into a sum over these irreducible representations. Of course, you can have states with multiple chords, so what do we do with those? And the answer is we use the co-product and then we decompose them into a sum of irreducible representations. So this is some sort of Clebsch-Gordan problem where we have a multi-chord state with arbitrary amounts of matter, species, and so forth, and we eventually decompose this complicated reducible representation of the chord algebra into irreducible representations. Okay, so this is just some technical aside, but we can also define some chord blocks which are projectors onto a particular irrep, and they are very analogous to the Virasoro blocks. So they sum, for example, all combinations of HL and H-right, which are like stress tensor insertions. Okay, and then using a special property of the co-product, we can prove a version of co-associativity or something very closely analogous to something called the crossing symmetry. Right? So in diagrams, we can take a state, let's say, with two particles. We can decompose it into irreducible representations. So these are some sort of one-particle states, which you get in the middle of the wormhole here. And we can do that in two different ways. So we can either cut the wormhole like this, or we can cut it in the S channel. Right? And in either the T channel or the S channel, in each case, we can decompose the states into some sort of irreducible representations. These irreducible representations are nothing but sort of the Q-deformed analogs of the double trace primaries that you might be familiar with in, let's say, free field theory in ADS. Okay? But something that's very strange is that we get two kinds of double traces. So we get two double traces for each possible matter combinations, and that's twice the number that we would expect from free field theory in ADS2. And the fact that we get more than what we expected is going to be related to the inelastic states. So in case you were a bit lost in the technical details, we found some algebra. We then did some algebra representation stuff where we decomposed the Hilbert space of the full theory into irreducible representations of the algebra, and then we identified some funny irreps which perhaps might be related to the scattering states and the states that will be generated later, okay? Now, now we come to the part of the goal that I said in the beginning, which is trying to understand the chaos exponent. So to come back to this point, we want to study a particular subalgebra which commutes with the chord number. So this is a particular subalgebra generated by one creation and one annihilation operator, so it manifestly commutes with the total chord number, right? And there are three particular generators. Taking the lambda goes to zero limit, we find that these particular generators form an SL2 algebra. And this SL2 algebra is valid at all temperatures. Okay, so this was quite surprising to us. The reason why it was surprising to us was because we thought that the SL2 algebra meant that there should be maximal chaos, right? That was some sort of argument that I presented in the beginning. And now I'm telling you that there's an SL2 algebra that's valid at all temperatures and all couplings, which nevertheless is overlaps with the regime where we think that the chaos exponent should be submaximal, right? So that was quite curious to us. And in order to debug this confusion, we studied how the generators act on the boundary. So what we found really surprised us then, which is the following. So we considered simply what happens when you act with these generators on states generated by inserting one operator somewhere on the boundary. And we found that how these generators act is completely the standard way in which the generators act on a circle. Okay, this is the circle phi, the angular coordinate. However, phi here is not the same as theta. Instead, what you have to do is you label the circle with a bigger circle. So you start with a bigger circle, and you put on this bigger circle an angle phi, which is not the same as theta. So the points here on this solid contour are the physical points, and then there's some missing region here, which we call the fake region. Okay? And defining the coordinate phi in this way allows us to write the action of the SL2 in a completely standard manner. Okay? And importantly, once we do this, circumference of the fake circle now is precisely beta over v. So that is exactly what we would have expected from the finite chaos exponent, right? So repeating the same derivation that we said in the beginning, but now using a different relationship between beta and h accounted for by this fake circle circumference, we get the correct chaos exponent at finite temperature, okay? So that was a bit weird. So we got some sort of geometrical explanation of the submaximal chaos, but it is quite unfamiliar, and so in order to study it a little bit more, we worked out some more consequences. And one of the first consequences we have is we have some symmetry, we find some Ward identities. So it implies some certain things about correlation functions, right? So the simplest case is the two-point function, which it implies that it's conformally covariant on the fake circle or the fake disk. So this is indeed the form that was first found by Mattelson and Stanford, and it explains why it looks so close to the conformal answer. So it looks like a conformal two-point function where you replace the standard thetas, but with these fake phis. Okay, so that was something we already knew, so you might not be too impressed, but we actually computed something further, which is we worked out what its implications are for the certain four-point functions. So the implications for the four-point function is that it should only be a function of the fake cross ratio. So this is a cross ratio on the circle, but again, we're using fake coordinates now as opposed to real coordinates. And indeed, you can check that this particular four-point function is completely independent of any of the details of the temperature and so forth. The only dependence of this four-point function is through the fake cross ratio. And furthermore, it's a very concrete function, and we can expand it in terms of conformal blocks. When we expand it in terms of conformal blocks, we generate an expansion over sums of primaries like we had before. And in fact, these coefficients, c squared of k, are exactly related in the way that we expect to this Clebsch-Gordan problem involving this chord algebra that we discussed in the previous slides. So we not only just understand the fact that it's a function of the cross ratio, but we actually understand the full function. We can use this fancy chord algebra technique to predict exactly what this four-point OTOC should be. Okay, so you might have found this still quite mysterious, and if you do, then you're not alone. So let's try one more thing. So let's try starting with a state which is in the physical region. So we just consider just the insertion of a particle, and then we try to move it into the fake region by acting with some of the symmetry generators, right? So the symmetry generators act on the full circle, so if we act with the symmetry generator, we can move it into one of the fake regions with no problem, right? So if we do that, we can ask, what do the fake states look like in the actual chord Hilbert space, right? We have some finite chord Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space of the wormhole. What do the states actually look like in that Hilbert space? And the answer is the following. So here we consider some smooth wave function, which you can think of as a particle sitting somewhere in the wormhole close to the right-hand side, okay? We act with the symmetry generator, it moves it into the fake region, and what happens is, as it goes into the fake region, the wave function starts to get totally crazy, right? So by totally crazy, I mean both that it oscillates rapidly, so it's actually oscillating on the scale of lambda, the discreteness scale, and that its magnitude is huge, so it's like actually 10 to the 18 times bigger than this, okay? So it's some totally crazy looking state, but it's actually just related by a simple symmetry generator, okay? So what is going on? What's going on is that there's sort of two equivalent pictures. Okay, the first picture is you say, I have a wormhole, it's finite size, and I insist on using the Hilbert space description of this finite-sized wormhole. And I get an extremely complicated, wildly fluctuating state, so I've tried to illustrate that here. The second possibility is you say, okay, the wormhole actually is not just the wormhole that we naively expected, but there's some sort of additional region which we call the fake region. And this additional region which we call the fake region is not symmetry. The claim is that both of these descriptions are correct, but of course the right-hand side is a much more efficient description of what's actually going on. And it's pretty crazy that a description which just involves smooth states in some fake region would actually reproduce the results of these wave functions that are wildly oscillating in some very crazy way. But we actually checked this both numerically and in certain cases analytically. So we checked that states in the fake region really do reproduce the results of these crazy looking wave functions in the real region. Okay, as lambda goes to zero. Okay, so to give a sort of high-level summary, what we think is that the fake disk is a picture which makes submaximal chaos manifest. The reason it makes submaximal chaos manifest is because the circumference of the circle is not beta, but this extra large, you know, region. So this extra large region allows you to change the chaos exponent. And using the symmetry algebra, it doesn't just say that it's, you know, bigger, but it actually specifies exactly how much bigger it is, and that amount agrees with the known chaos exponent of large PSYK. Now, of course, understanding what that fake region means is a slightly harder problem, and we think that it has to do with the representation of certain subtle states. So these are these crazy-looking states that I just showed you. And to give you an analogy, it's a bit like the chiral fermion problem on the lattice that we heard a little bit about. So the idea is the following. So in the chiral fermion problem, right, you're interested in producing, let's say, only purely right movers, right? So you make these nice smooth wave functions on your lattice, and those are the right movers. But usually what happens is on the lattice, there's also these crazy, highly oscillating functions which end up becoming the left movers, right? So you can't easily just create a lattice system which has just you know, right movers, but because of some lattice effect, you typically generate left movers. In the continuum description, it's usually, if you wanted to give a continuum description of such a lattice system, you would say that it's not a chiral fermion, but includes both right movers and left movers. And the fake disk is a bit like that. So the fake region is a bit like this extra, the fake regions account for states which involve these left moving, which are analogous to the left moving fermions on the lattice, okay? The fermions that you didn't want, okay? But it's a genuine feature of the finite lambda theory that must be accounted for as you take lambda goes to zero. And what I didn't completely have time to explain is that the scattering states that we set up, so the actual description of the inelastic states, for example, the difference between the outgoing state at very late times in Lorentzian signature when you have two particles and the ingoing state actually has a very similar flavor, okay? So we believe that this fake disk accounts for not just the submaximal chaos, but really some of the details of why the chaos is submaximal, some details about the inelastic scattering, and very detailed forms about the four-point function, et cetera. So a general question that I would like to discuss is what are the lessons for submaximal chaos in general in situations which are not just a large PSYK? And with that, I'll thank you for your attention. Yeah.
Hey, thank you for an interesting talk. So how did you obtain the crazy wave function in the real Hilbert space analytically? It seems really difficult.
Yeah, so first let me say how we did it. First let me say how we did it numerically. So if you want, you can just truncate the Hilbert space to finite dimension, right? So in particular, you can consider a state where there's a wormhole of some fixed length. Let's say n equals 100, so that's a fixed wormhole, and then you can consider a matter particle just sitting in the wormhole, right? And because the symmetry generators commute with the length operator of the wormhole, acting with the symmetry generators does not change the wormhole from an n equals 100 wormhole to any other kind of wormhole, right? So it's consistent to truncate the Hilbert space to that finite dimensional Hilbert space, and then act with the symmetry generators in that way. So we have some very concrete expressions for the symmetry generators that involve these creation and annihilation operators, et cetera. Acting with those generators, we're able to figure out what happens to the wave function as it goes further. Now, analytically, it's also possible in some very special cases. So for some special combinations of the symmetry generators, which are E plus B, we were able to work out how the wave function evolves. And that involves, you know, Q math, basically. So you solve some recursion relation, some special functions, et cetera. So it's sort of a nasty formula, but we really checked this. And what we really checked is that when you take lambda goes to zero, the overlaps between different states are reproduced by the fake disk. Okay. So one thing I didn't explain is why the amplitude here is so big, right? And the amplitude here is so big because the inner product is highly non-trivial. So the inner product actually smooths out these wave functions. And so in order for this state to have a finite norm, because of these oscillations getting smoothed out, it has to have a huge amplitude. So you can think of the inner product as like smearing this thing out. When it smears out a highly oscillating thing, it will generally decrease its amplitude to much, you know, smaller amount. So in order to keep that state to actually have finite norm, you have to start with something that's huge. And
so in the marginal case, like A equals just zero, you get more smaller amplitude, and the wave function looks more smooth.
Yeah, so the case on the left is not the case where we have a fake state. The case on the left is just some initial smooth state that we then evolve, let's say.
Okay.
So let's say this is a state which corresponds to the particle in the middle of the wormhole. You know, it's not in the fake region. The state on the right is the state that you get from translating this particle, which was naively in the real wormhole, real part of the wormhole, into the fake region. So that's how you can roughly think about this.
Thank you.
Hi, I have two related questions. So one is that when you introduced the co-product, it looked like there was a special type of particle at which you could break the wormhole up.
Yes.
The second question is, what was the relevance of the co-product for your fake geometry?
Okay, let me try to explain the co-product in a little bit more detail. So the idea is we have a tensor factor of two copies of the Hilbert space, right? So here's the Hilbert space of the wormhole, and here's another totally independent copy of the Hilbert space, right? And so we can have different states in these Hilbert spaces. And the idea is that the coproduct is related to this operation of joining the two states. So you literally have two, you know, Einstein-Rosen bridges, and you put the wormhole mouths together, right? When you join the wormholes together, you can have the option of inserting a particle, okay? So that's this blue cord here. So the idea was these were two generic wormholes. We put them together and we add a matter particle when we insert them. Okay, you have the option of adding any kind of matter that you like. So that's related to the fact that there's this parameter delta in the coproduct, which corresponds to what kind of matter you insert when you join the two wormholes. Yes, you can think of it that way. Yes, you can think of that. So it's labeled by both the dimension, and there's also a hidden index, which delta, for example, has a hidden index, which is the species of the matter. Yes, you can think of it that way. I'm sorry, what was your second question? Yeah, so the point was that the coproduct allows you to generate multiparticle states. So for example, you could start out with two wormholes that are completely empty, that have no matter particles at all. Then acting with the coproduct, you build a one particle state, right? Or you could start with, you know, two wormhole states with one particle, and then you would get, let's say, a three-particle state. So the coproduct allows you to build a complicated wormhole with many different particles in it. And what we did in the first part was to decompose that into irreducible representations, which are these, you can think of it as some, you know, one heavy particle sitting in the middle of the wormhole. The point was that the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that appeared in that kind of decomposition, these kind of gammas, are related closely to these, conformal block expansion of the OTOC. So there's some close relationship between the algebraic structure of this whole chord algebra and the fact that you know, there's some particular function here, which is what you get in the OTOC. Yeah.
So then we have a question on Zoom by Eric Perlmutter. Eric, can you unmute yourself?
Hi. So you ended your talk with a question.
Yes.
What are the general lessons for some maximal chaos. Maybe can you offer some preliminary answer to that question?
Sure, I can attempt a speculative answer. So, well, one concrete thing that you could ask is, what are the lessons for just P equals 4 SYK, right? So does P equals 4 SYK have any signs of fakeness versus P equals infinity SYK, right? And the answer is that there's a quantitative sense in which the answer is yes. So in particular, in a previous paper by Gu, Kataev, and Zhang, they did some numerical computations involving the G and sigma action and so forth that effectively we interpret as computing the ratio of the chaos exponent to what you would guess would be the fake chaos exponent in Q equals 4 SYK. So let me try to explain that. So one definition of the chaos exponent, of course, is just what you get in the OTOC. That's the standard definition. The other candidate sort of thing that you might compare it to is the circumference of the fake circle, right? And you can define the circumference of a fake circle at any P by looking at the domain of analyticity of the two-point function. Okay, so the fake region here in the fake circle was related to the fact that the two-point function has a singularity exactly at this location. So the amount of fakeness that you add is closely related to the domain of analyticity of the two-point function. Okay, so if you repeat that exercise for P equals 4 SYK, you can make some plot. And of course, reinterpreting the previous results of this paper, we can see that the ratio of those two things is extremely close to 1. So in some sense, let's say at a generic temperature like beta J equals 10, by this measure at least, the fake effects in P equals 4 SYK is like 99% of the effects of the submaximal chaos. Okay, so that's just that's not intended to be super serious. This is just intended to illustrate that there even in P equals 4 SYK, we think that there's some version of this fakeness going on. Now, of course, you might say, well, P equals 4 SYK is very similar, so can you speculate about some case like N equals 4 super Yang Mills at finite temperature or at finite TUF parameter? Yeah, I think I'm not qualified to make such speculations, but I hope that some other people will tell me about it. Yeah.
My question, Javier?
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. So for a generic chaotic system with a generic Lyapunov exponent, you can always describe it with an inverted harmonic oscillator at a small, for small perturbations, no? At the beginning, you can always describe it with an inverted harmonic oscillator, which has an SL2R symmetry. And that initial form of chaos, you can understand it as a movement in the SL2R manifold, which is what you are calling maybe the fake geometry, no? I guess. Well, that's my question. In the sense, it is fake. I mean, it is the real movement because it's the one that has the right modified Lyapunov exponent, but it's fake because the geometry needs to be is not the same as the black hole geometry with the right temperature. It's the intuition.
I'm not sure I follow.
Well, maybe we can discuss.
Yeah.
Sorry.